When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at Remarkable.com today.
Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America.
Good night, and good luck.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Lincoln Project Podcast. I'm your host, Rick Wilson. And today we have a really interesting book to talk about by two guests. George Monbiot and Peter Hutchison have written a book called Invisible Doctrine, The Secret History of Neoliberalism. Now, this is one of those things that's sort of the magic of the Lincoln Project. You have to break your old predicates about how things work. And I would have told you 10 years ago that I was a rabid free markets guy, and I still believed for a long time that what we had in America was a free market system, but we really don't. And it's been more and more obvious that this is not a system that's based on market principles at all anymore. And we might be approaching this, you know, me more from the right and them more from the left, but this is a fascinating book. I was reading it last night, and it really does break down a lot of the illusions about the fact that we – in the West particularly, we posture about free market capitalism a lot, but what we have ain't that. So with that, I want to welcome you guys to the show. Thank you so much for coming on. And tell me about the origin story of this book. I always ask authors that, like, where did this book come from in your work? Tell me about what your big findings are, and let's talk it through about where you think the actual global economy is versus the one the sort of fairy story we tell ourselves about it.
So perhaps I could start off by answering the first question. Peter and I have never met. We've written a book and made a film together, but we have never actually met. We've seen each other like this. He lives in California. I live in the UK. We've done
George,
the whole
actually,
thing remotely.
I actually live in Brooklyn, I think.
Oh, sorry, in Brooklyn. I'm sorry, Peter. Yes, yeah, you live in Brooklyn. And I live in the UK. And we've done the whole thing remotely, which maybe is a first. I'm not sure if there's any book which has ever been written by two people together who haven't met. but it started off, and Peter can explain this, with his proposal for a film.
Well, you know, I as a filmmaker, I had long been interested in making a film that explored this, you know, these issues and theories around neoliberalism, where it comes from, what it means. Some of the smartest people that I know, when the issue of neoliberalism comes up, they kind of know what it means, they kind of understand it, but have a really difficult time articulating it, and also don't know contextually where it comes from and how it became sort of conventional wisdom in a sense, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of people have this this feeling or understanding of it, that it just sort of organically evolved as sort of the best response to the economy, which is far, far, far from the case, right?
Right.
So I had come across George's article from 2016 in The Guardian, the neoliberalism, the ideology at the root of all our problems. And a light bulb went off over my head. I said, I have never read anyone who so articulately and entertainingly explains what neoliberalism mm-hmm. is, where it comes from, and the impact that it's had on our lives. So I reached out to George and I said, hey, would you be interested in collaborating on a film about this? And right. we actually started working on the film before the book. George and I worked out a way of filming, thanks to technology, across the Atlantic in real time. And we had a radio cut of the film with a transcript, and that's basically what we pitched to Penguin, who said, "We love your transcript. This is fantastic. We need a lot more words, but yeah, we'd love to collaborate on a book with you about this."
Tell me, guys, or especially tell our audience, what is neoliberalism?
Neoliberalism was a phrase coined, a word coined in 1938 at a meeting in Paris among a group of economists who were unhappy with the way they perceived that the world was going. They saw, on the one hand, totalitarianism, Nazism, Stalinism, and on the other hand, what they saw as a kind of state collectivization, the sort of development of a welfare state. The idea was just beginning to hatch then, the development of major publicly funded services. And they thought that these were all part of the same continuum. And by the time its leading lights in 1944 had published their books, Friedrich Hayek's book, The Sure. Road to Serfdom, and Ludwig von Mises's book, Bureaucracy, they had really formulated what I see as a gigantic slippery slope fallacy, that any attempt by governments to protect people from falling through the economic cracks, any attempts to provide robust public services would lead inevitably to totalitarianism. It would end up with Stalin. It would end right. up with Hitler. And so we must stop any such attempts from happening. And while some very rich people quickly became extremely interested in what they were saying and started pouring a lot of money into developing their doctrine, by and large, their views were considered pretty repulsive, because what they wanted to do was to sweep away any impediments to what they saw as a kind of natural order of the deserving and the undeserving. And you could tell who the deserving were because they had money, and you could tell who the undeserving were because they didn't. And that's the way it ought to be. So anything which stops that natural order from emerging, such as taxation and redistribution, such as public services, such as an economic safety net, such as trade unions, such as protesters, such as democracy itself, was going to weaken and vitiate society and damage its vitality, because it would prevent the natural winners from coming out on top. And so they saw inequality as being a good thing. But paradoxically, and in a wildly contradictory way, they said that if we have lots of inequality, the wealth generated by the very rich will trickle down and enrich people at the bottom. But hang on a moment. People at the bottom aren't supposed to be enriched. They're supposed to stay poor under this philosophy. Right. So straight away, there were some very big contradictions embedded in this belief system. But it was extremely appealing to some of the world's richest people, and literally some of the richest people on earth and some of the richest corporations poured a very large amount of money into creating an international network around this doctrine.
So, as we've watched this idea, there's always been a sort of, and again, this is one of the things, is as a former Republican, a guy who believed in free markets, the realization that our markets are much more controlled, much more managed, not by the evils of government, but by, a lot of incredibly powerful interests and cartels. And it's like almost the opposite. I guess the irony of the branding of the free market West versus the reality of it is what struck me about reading this book last night, of how few actual areas of economic freedom do exist under this system. It really is a less free, and less robust system for protecting individual rights. It would be hard to come up with one that's worse other than like straight up Soviet communism, maybe.
Well, I think you've got a great point. There is an inherent contradiction in neoliberalism. Even in the language itself, right? I mean, this, as far as neoliberalism is concerned, that liberalism, that freedom is a freedom that is granted towards the wealthy elite, towards corporations, towards the elite business class, at the expense of everybody else. And this concept of free market capitalism, as you aptly point out, there is nothing free market about our version of quote unquote free market laissez-faire capitalism, right? I mean, if you take all you have to do, all anyone has to do is take a look at this series of government corporate bailouts that have existed from, you know, 70s onward. You know, we live in a very sophisticated system of corporate welfare, of which bailouts are only a piece of.
If 2008 didn't teach us anything about the socialization of risk and putting it all on Americans, what will?
Well, that's a great question. This is something that we do address at length in the book. George has this wonderful way of talking about how the only thing we can replace a story with is a story. And I think when the 2008 financial crisis happened, there wasn't another story to replace the one that was being used. This concept of neoliberalism, there wasn't another proposed alternative to step in and take place. So I think it very much felt like doubling down on a pre-existing system. And, you know, it is very cynically, you know, you see the fox being led into the hen house, right? Like the very people who were supposed to be regulating what was happened were brought into the administration and brought into these ad hoc committees to manage the financial crisis. And you don't have to, you know, you don't have to be a rocket science to figure out what's going to happen if the very people who created the financial crisis are brought into to create solutions for it. So yes, I think it does feel like in some ways, you know, people threw up their hands and said, okay, they've won. But I think the important piece of it is that there wasn't an alternative, which is if you dig back into the history of neoliberalism and you see what happened with the collapse of Keynesian economics in the 70s, you know, this system that had been discussed and developed in think tanks and universities for decades was ready to step in as this alternative to Keynesianism, and was quite easily adopted by the Carter administration and then of course full bore with the Reagan administration.
So I think one of the paradoxes of neoliberalism is that it claims to support an entrepreneurial society. It claims to be a doctrine which promotes enterprise. But by removing all constraints on how the very wealthy can behave, it actually creates a new society of rent, a rentier economy, where a small number of people can effectively parasitize other people's economic activity. And some of those people might be financiers. Some of them might be property moguls, and we can think of a particular property mogul who's made a career in parasitizing other people's productive activity. Some of them might be people who have been effectively handed the keys to public services, where essential public services that people need to use. Here in the UK, for instance, our water has been privatized, and a bunch of extremely predatory companies now own our water services, and we have to pay them massively over the odds for the right to have water coming out of our faucets. And so we end up with this really crazy situation where we are paying rent, an entry fee to use an essential service, paying way over the odds for what that service is worth, because the system which was supposed to create an enterprise society has taken all the political breaks off the activities of the very wealthy. And so we end up with a situation where they can basically just impose what is effectively a private tax on the rest of us.
And the other piece, Rick, which you aptly, you know, pointed out is that, you know, it's not just an issue of too big to fail. It's when these essential, you know, public and social services are privatized, you know, it becomes this corporate safety net, right? Like, we can't afford to lose these services. They're essential to our health, to our well-being, to society functioning. So the state assumes the risk of the privatization because we can't allow these you know services to fall apart.
You know, one of the questions I have in this is, you know, you mentioned the rentier society. Is this sort of transition from treating people as if they're citizens to treating them as if they are only consumers? And I think that is necessarily pernicious to any kind of system with any kind of pretense to democracy.
I think this is an essential thing to recognize, that you know, together we are powerful, apart we are powerless. And as if we are redefined as consumers rather than citizens, we are pushed apart. We are each in our homes, thinking that we can change the world by buying a different brand of biscuits. We patently cannot do that. It's only by coming together, forming effective political movements, that we can generate political change. And so the impetus of neoliberals and neoliberal governments has been to atomize and rule. If we can push people apart, they no longer present a threat to the most predatory forms of capital and rent seeking. And so we can just carry on creating an ever more unequal and predatory society. One of the things that Peter and I are trying to do in this book is to reclaim the notion of citizenship, to reclaim our role as active, engaged political citizens, building a meaningful democracy, rather than just putting a cross on a piece of paper once every 4 years and then leaving governments to get on with it and to do their best or do their worst, to do whatever they want to do, whatever they can push through Congress, whatever they can push through Parliament. A system, in other words, that's based on presumed consent, where our consent is presumed for everything a winning party does. We don't accept that principle in sex. Why should we accept it in politics? Instead, Peter and I want to see a genuine grassroots democracy being built from the bottom up, where we have a far greater say in the decisions that affect our lives. And we put forward some proposals for how that could work.
Talk to me a little bit about those proposals, Peter.
I think there's all kinds of really remarkable examples of how participatory democracy, participatory budgeting are being put into practice around the world. Mm-hmm. You know, strikingly, this isn't just happening in, you know, South American and Scandinavian countries. There's been 40 examples of cities around the United States that have adopted this strategy and have explored and experimented with different forms of it. And I think it's a really, really exciting new idea. Well, it's not new, but it's new for Americans. That's for sure. Right. You know, and it's this idea that, you know, you can take a certain percentage of a municipal budget and you can allow citizens and community members to collaborate around decision making in terms of how that money is spent, because they know best what's needed in their communities, right? They know how to spend the money in a way that is going to be most efficient, most effective, is going to create the kind of changes that elevate their quality of living. And so they've found through these experiments that the money is spent far more efficiently. The results are hugely increased, mm-hmm. And accelerated. And people, importantly to your initial point, is people feel more engaged with the democratic process, and they feel more engaged with their community, right? Like it's a process that allows people to come together in this participatory forum. And so it fulfills a lot of these different aspects of, I think, what George and I are talking about in terms of creating a more of a society of belonging.
I'm curious about one of the things that seems to be emerging, not only in Europe, but in the United States right now. There is an increasing authoritarian populist movement around the world that seems to be using more populist economics as its hook. Now, I think we'd all agree that their intentionality of people like Orban and Trump and Bolsonaro and all these other folks and is not the uplift of their citizenry. But how dangerous is that? Is that sort of seductive populism on the far right to trying to make a more equitable economic system around the world?
I think it's incredibly dangerous, and I think when people sense that a government no longer reflects their interests or hears them or is being responsive to their needs, they seek more extreme answers. I mean, we see this in Trump, right? You know, there's no solutions that are being offered up, but people would rather, you know, burn it all down and shake things up than continue with the form of government that they feel isn't representing their needs, right? And I think you talk about this quite a bit with your own work, right? And I think we don't see this. We see this not only in Trump. We see this sort of in right wing authoritarian.
How do you overcome the objection that a lot of neoliberals and a lot of I'll put it in the category of sort of deluded economic conservatives? How do you overcome the objection that oh, this is just a pure democracy is going to lead to a whole host of excesses, and this is just, you know, this is trying to backdoor socialize the entire economy? I don't think those are all valid critiques, but they're critiques I know they'll make. So how do you work that problem?
This of course is an issue that dates back to the founding of our country. It was a very widely debated issue amongst the founding fathers. This issue around, too much democracy being a dangerous thing.
Sure.
That the masses can't govern themselves. You know, that there has to be, you know, a group of sort of wiser, learned men to sort of make sure everything was running correctly, and that too much democracy wouldn't result, because then there's a danger that everyone might rise up, revolt, and overthrow the government if they felt like their needs weren't being met. So, and it's a real fascinating, it kind of goes to the core of I think who we are as America structurally, right? And there's also a lot of wordplay that goes in with these, you know, these concepts of democracy and socialism. I mean, most of us are aware of this, but, you know, you look at the, you know, FDR's New Deal and what some people consider some of the, you know, the greatest, you know, social policies ever put into practice, right? That we see as fundamental to our to how we make a commitment to people and to our society, right? And are these socialist, you know, concepts? I mean, in some ways they are, but we're putting them into practice within the context of a quote unquote democracy. And I think it's easy to throw these words around and throw people off track. And I think that's a big piece of what we explore in the book, right? We explore language. We explore how language has been used to confuse people and to mislead people.
Well, I think that is it is one of those great paradoxes in American society. The classic moment during the Tea Party rally where the guy holds up the sign that says, "Keep your government hands off my Medicare." I mean, the ironies of those sort of things abound. We have in America what I call just the tip socialism. The minute you say to these people, "I'm taking away your disability check," they race to their MAGA monster truck and start screaming about the Marxists are taking away their God-given right to a disability check.
That's right.
It, it is an irony. And that is one of the things I worry about with this populist movement out there is they will, and they're very good at convincing people that they've had their livelihood stolen by Mexicans, when it's really McKinsey and Goldman and Bain that are stealing their livelihoods much more effectively, much more brilliantly. And those folks are protected by an enormous regulatory system that they essentially control.
Right. And that's the beauty of the bait and switch, right?
And the scapegoating, the xenophobia, the culture wars, they're all designed as camouflaging smoke clouds behind which the McKinseys and the Bains and Goldman Sachs and the other predatory forms of capital can operate. And you know, they need that distraction. Without that distraction, we would turn on them, as indeed we should be doing. But unfortunately, the distraction, which is the oldest trick in the book, it was done by the Romans, it turns out still to be highly effective.
You know, there was a case this week where the Biden Justice Department came down and arrested a bunch of people in Atlanta, including the largest apartment rental guy in a rental company in Atlanta. They were using a piece of software that allowed them to price fix among multiple companies, so that all the landlords in Atlanta, or not all, but a vast majority of them, were using this one piece of software to allow them to collude and raise rents strategically. And every time somebody left an apartment, they would all know, and they would start jacking the rent. So rents in Atlanta have gone up something like 185% in 3 years. That's not inflation. That is something deeper and more grotesque. And I want to talk a little bit about how the differential in available information was always the argument that these you know, hedge funds and private equity funds have used in the last few years. We understand better how things are going to run. But it turns out a lot of that is we understand better how to screw consumers. Talk to me a little bit about where that is. And do you think that is driving enough righteous anger in the system right now? Because I think there are people who are at a breaking point. If they think they can just blame Joe Biden for it, you know, that's convenient for Trump and the Republicans, but I don't think you can legitimately hold on to that argument in the face of the facts.
Mm. So, you know, one of the myths of the perfect neoliberal market is that it's informed by perfect information,
right?
But there's massive asymmetries of information. And as you so rightly say, Rick, you know, people use that asymmetric access to information to rig the market, to screw consumers, to screw other businesses. And those asymmetries will always exist, not least because the economy has become more and more opaque during the neoliberal era, as various rules which would have maintained its transparency have been stripped away. You know, and this was one of the tragedies of the destruction of Glass-Steagall, where it just opened up the opportunity to create a whole range of opaque, exotic financial instruments, which
third-order derivatives.
Yeah, exactly, which nobody really understood. I mean, one of the things we discovered is that even the people who were trading the derivatives didn't really understand what they were and what they did and what their implications were. So
correct.
The asymmetry of information had become so extreme that actually you ended up with no information at all. It just became this massively opaque system. It was a black box. And that's devastating to political democracy, but it's also devastating to economic democracy.
Mm-hmm.
And so you end up with something which is actually the opposite of the marketplace. You know, if you think of a market, you think of a street market, that's a place where the participants are roughly equal. The buyers and the sellers, they're roughly equal economic status. You know, no one monopolizes it. No one says, I own all these stalls. And I mean, yeah, the stall holders have to pay rent, but that's to a different system. But no one is saying, you can't step into this street market without paying a fee to me. And what we've developed over the past 40, 45 years has been the opposite of a market economy. It's been an economy which is all about access fees. It's all about control of information. It's all about black boxes. And if you want access to a black box, you have to pay a massive amount of money. It's about people who are in privileged positions, which enables them to screw other people. And so, you know, one of the many paradoxes of neoliberalism is that it has developed exactly the opposite system to what it said it would produce. And right. Moreover, just as it said that, you know, the welfare state, collectivism, government intervention will lead to a new era of autocracy and totalitarianism. Well, if anything is leading to that new era, it's this collapse of fair standards, collapse of a level playing field, collapse of an equality of engagement, both in the economic arena and in the political arena, that neoliberalism mm-hmm. itself has ushered in. So it sort of delivered exactly the thing that it said it was trying to prevent.
This is related to these issues that we talk about when George and I discuss things about participatory democracy and the fact that, at least in the United States, you cast your vote once every 4 years, right? And then all these other processes go into effect without any input whatsoever. There was no public debate around the repeal of Glass-Steagall. Most people didn't even know what it was. And it was maybe one of the most important decisions that were made in that entire economic decisions in that entire decade, right? People had no idea the restrictions that, you know, were being stripped away and what that outcome would be.
I think that is so important here, and I think this is a really important discussion because I think there is a strange possibility that people on the legitimate economic free market right and people on the left and center left understand that there's something out there that's breaking both of our aspirational systems where markets and economies lift people up. Because increasingly the subscription economy, the rentier economy, and this regulatory capture by the people who are running those things, not just the goods producing side of it, but the economic industry side of it. I think this is a really important book for this moment, guys, because we really are facing a lot of choices about where the country and where the world goes. And at the end of the day, it strikes me as a very consequential decision the world's going to have to make of, do you allow a purely corporatized system that is a, you know, sort of kleptocracy, oligarchy model to survive over individual liberty, individual rights, and free market democracy in a way that will empower and uplift people. So with that, I want to thank George Monbiot and Peter Hutchison for coming on the show today. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. The book is Invisible Doctrine, The Secret History of Neoliberalism. Thank you again, George and Peter, for coming on the show. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks for having us, Rick. It's a pleasure.